Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm here with Dr. Paul Slovic. He's a founder and president of Decision Research and professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, where he studies human judgment, decision making, and risk analysis. He and his colleagues worldwide have developed methods to describe risk perceptions and measure their impacts on individuals, industry, and society. Dr. Slovic is a past president of the Society for Risk Analysis. He's also the recipient of several awards, and he was also elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2015 and the National Academy of Sciences in 2016. So, Dr. Slovic, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show.
My pleasure, Ricardo. Looking forward to talking with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Okay, so let me first ask you, because I guess that a lot of the work that you do is based on how people process information, on how people are affected by certain types of information they are exposed to, and how their decision-making processes work when they are exposed to those types of information, let's say. And so it is also based on biases and heuristics, right? So, I mean, even in today's society, in a scientific modern world, wouldn't you say that perhaps these biases and heuristics that people are subject to might still have some value, at least some of the time, or do they always lead to negative consequences?
Yes, very interesting question. I think another way to phrase your question would be, does scientific information have value for us in a world where we are still mostly dependent on these ancient forms of thinking that
Right.
lead to heuristics and biases? Yeah, it's a there's a lot of things that come to mind with regard to your question. So we think in two ways. We know that one is kind of intuitive and using our kind of gut feelings, and the other is kind of analytic, based on logic, reason, scientific information. But that's a more recent development of the human brain to be able to think that way, and the survival of the human species throughout the period of evolution depended mostly on this intuitive gut feeling type of thinking. And that's still very much with us today and influencing us a lot. I was just listening to a disturbing story on the news this morning about protests by people who were worried that they were going to be forced to vaccinate their children against diseases because they fear vaccination to be harmful, even though it's scientifically shown to be not only quite safe but extremely beneficial. And yet their fears are such that they are out in the streets protesting against being forced to vaccinate their children. Well, I think this is an example of the tension between our kind of intuitive fears and what the world of science tells us. And it's very much present today, and influencing us in this dynamic is very important to understand in trying to think about, well, what is rational, what is not, how should society respond when people are making judgments and decisions based on this intuitive feeling sense, as opposed to what data and science tells them. So this is kind of a dynamic that's being played out today, as it has for many thousands of years.
Yes, I guess that we're going to go back to this question later in the interview, that is perhaps the relationship between lay people and the experts. But I guess that it is also very difficult for people nowadays in this world where we have a lot of information from different areas. I mean, it is very difficult for people to really have a good grasp of the relevant information from all these different areas, and perhaps we could talk about politics or the environment or even scientific disciplines, including medicine and vaccination and things like that, and to really evaluate them properly. I mean, and on the other hand, we have the experts, but sometimes perhaps people are a bit afraid of relying too much on the experts, and they feel like they are being patronized or something like that. So, I mean, it's a bit difficult to deal with all of these complex issues, right?
Yes, there's a sense in which we have more information available to us today than ever before. So we have to be selective in what we pay attention to. And what we're finding is that people are selecting information that makes them feel good and conforms what they do believe and what they want to believe and what their friends believe. So there's
That's the confirmation bias, correct?
Yes. And also kind of a cultural, what we call, what some scholars like Dan Kahan at the Yale Law School have called cultural cognition, that our thinking is directed by our cultural ideologies and predispositions, so that we tend to relate to people who are like us, and we share information and ideas and beliefs with people who are like us and who reinforce our beliefs. And we all feel good about that, and then we sort of together oppose the other groups that think differently from us. And there's a lot of conflict that is generated there, and it's very hard to penetrate that with information. We find that, when new information comes out, that the different ideological groups interpret that information in different ways, supportive of their beliefs. It doesn't necessarily bring people together as we would hope it would. Rather, it is spinned and reflected and reinforced in ways that amplify one's beliefs, or maybe even further the polarization. So that's kind of a very worrisome situation, which I think is prevalent today. Maybe it's always been with us to a sense, but never quite in the same way, because the nature of where we get our information has changed so much in this digital world. Like you and I are talking together for thousands of miles apart over digital technologies. In the past, we would have been writing letters to each other.
Right, and they would have taken a few weeks to arrive or even months, right?
Right, and we would, think carefully. If you get a letter, you spend a lot of time thinking about it and crafting a thoughtful reply. And those days seem to be gone.
Yes, so let me ask you, do you think that the approach that some people have, like for example, Daniel Kahneman, of thinking of things and separating them between system one and system two, or perhaps fast and slow thinking processes, or intuitive knowledge and reflective knowledge, whatever you want to call them, that is a useful approach? And I'm also asking you this because I don't know if this makes sense, but when I think about these things, like for example, the fact that even when people are a little bit more reflective about their decisions and things like that, many times what happens is that even their reflective processes are influenced by intuitions, and sometimes decisions that people make and justifications to those decisions that they come up with are sort of post hoc, rationalization. So I'm not sure if it is really that easy to make a strict division between the two types of systems, but I might be mistaken. So,
yes, very important question. So the word system is a bit controversial because it implies a very tightly coordinated set of responses that can all be linked to a system when it's not that simple as you're hinting. I think that the concept of fast and slow thinking that Kahneman has described is very important and very, very useful, although it's not a hard and fast and completely separate thing. I mean, I think that where does the line, is the line drawn between a fast response and a slow response? There's no quite answer to that, but I think it captures the notion that sometimes we receive information, we respond very quickly. Sometimes even in a small fraction of a second, we formulate a response or an action to something that comes to our attention. That's that's really, really fast, microseconds. The brain responds and we sense something is good or bad, or we need to run away or do something. And we're all familiar with thinking hard and thinking slowly about some problem and trying to to calculate well, something that's really takes hard thought, and we have to think about reasons, like if you're going to buy a car, and you're looking and the car is different ways, and do you want how important is safety and fuel economy and cost and all these sorts of things, and so we might want to do some analysis there. Although again, the fast part of the responding because we like the red color real quickly is also there. So both of these ways of responding are continually active in our brain, kind of in what we call the dance of affect, which is a jargon for feeling, the dance of affect and reason. They're dancing around in our brain and influencing us in ways that those of us who study this are trying to understand better. We know something about it, but there's a lot we need to know. So yes, I think that's a very important concept, and it's very important in my work trying to understand important behaviors. Maybe we'll discuss some of those later. On the other hand, so what we know is that both fast and slow thinking are highly sophisticated. I would say that they are rational ways of thinking. And what do I mean by rational? That's a loaded word. And for me, a rational response is a response that helps a person achieve their objectives. Whatever those objectives are, you may not agree with those objectives, but if it gets them where they want to go, it's rational for them. And so I think both of these ways of thinking are highly rational. The fast thinking helped us survive through aeons of evolutionary history, and it worked well enough that we're still here. And the slow thinking can create miracles. It can create these aluminum tubes that fly through this air at hundreds of miles an hour and 30,000 feet. It can get us the people on the moon or spacecraft on Mars or these sorts of things. So both ways of thinking are essential and valuable. However, both of them have limitations and they break down in certain situations. And so that's what I think is the important thing to try to understand, is when can we rely on and trust the fast mode? Where does it and how does it fail us? The same thing with the slow thinking, as you were pointing out. There are ways in which slow thinking can lead us astray. And what we talked about a little earlier, when we take information and we spin it to confirm our belief, that's slow thinking, which perverts information and doesn't really treat it for its real evidentiary value. So both ways of that are that our brain processes information are miraculous in many ways, and they both have flaws and limitations, and we need to understand both the benefits and the flaws of each type of thinking.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that you referred to what you consider to be rational behavior, and basically you said that it is something that allows a particular person or perhaps a society or a collective to arrive at their goals. So I would like to ask you if you don't think that perhaps the ways by which we classify things as biases, for example, if sometimes they don't have, if that classification sometimes doesn't have a sort of a moralistic side to it, in the sense that we first establish, either individually or collectively, what we consider to be good or bad goals or good or bad outcomes, and then according to that we see what are the sorts of ways of thinking that people have that lead toward bad outcomes or good outcomes, and the ones that lead them astray are the ones that we classify as biases. I mean, I'm not sure if this makes sense, but...
Yes, it does. So first I would say that the word bias basically doesn't have this inherent, doesn't necessarily have to have this good or bad element to it. A bias is a deviation from some expected value. So, and that is not necessarily bad. It's what it is that, you know, you think that people think that the temperature today is, such and such degrees Celsius, and no, in fact, it's 1 degree higher. Well, their judgment is biased in that sense, but that doesn't mean it's really bad or harmful. I mean, it's just a deviation. But I think that you're right that in underlying the work that began to be done in 1960s or 70s on biases, there was the thought that some of these could be dangerous or harmful. You know, that if you underestimated the likelihood that something is going to cause harm, then you wouldn't protect adequately against it. Things like that. So, so yes, there was the implication that these biases were problematic, and there's been now thousands of studies of all kinds of biases in the last 30 or 40 years, and I think some of them are truly harmful, and others are just, this is the way people think, and it's not necessarily good or bad, but it's interesting. So there's been a lot of work obviously done on this, and some people felt that this field was biased towards finding biases. Well, yes, it was, but it was on the assumption that we need to know this. Who was it? Socrates said, "Know thyself," and the work in this field is trying to get us to understand ourselves and the kind of the strange ways that our minds react when we take in information and try to use it. I personally feel that I'm studying ways that we are biased that are truly, truly harmful to the world, and that we need to understand and do something about it.
Mm-hmm. So just before we move on to talk about other concepts like bounded rationality and risk and risk perception and things like that, I wouldn't like to go on a tangent here and talk too much about this, but let me just ask you before we move on, don't you think that perhaps fast processes of thinking or thought are useful to people at least in the social environment or the social world? Because, I mean, in order for people to really be fluid in their interactions, they have to process information that they receive from other people in a very fast way. And if they didn't do that, if they were deliberative all the time, then perhaps it would be very awkward, and people and their interactions would be perhaps more difficult. Because, I mean, if I am exposed to someone that is part of a group about which I have a very particular type of stereotype, for example, it might lead to negative consequences if I'm acting automatically. But, I mean, in terms of the personal interaction, wouldn't it be very difficult for people to keep normal social interactions if they were trying to be completely aware of the ways they think and classify other people and try to be deliberative about it? Or don't you agree with that?
Yes, I agree. I mean, I can't see us walking around with little calculators or little computers where we see someone and we enter into the computer all the features that we see about that person, and we get a score as to, you know, whether we should go up and say hello to them or not, or, you know, whether it's, or we should cross the street and get away from them. I mean, clearly we have learned ways of reacting to our social environment through experience. A lot of it is taught by experience, and once you have experienced something, you get a very fast reaction that is kind of coded in by what happened the last time when I saw a person like this. And so, again, that can be valid or not, but that's the way we operate. We do learn from our, and we are experiencing things, obviously, from the day we're born, and then those are coded into very fast, fluid reactions, which enable us to function in society. And now, sometimes these reactions might be wrong. We might be taught, for example, to be prejudiced towards some people, you know, and then that's the way we respond quickly without thinking about, well, you know, why should we do this? You know, are these people really different and bad, you know, because they don't look like us or whatever, you know, so it can be, you know, harmful reaction, but you're right, it's fast and fluid. And We don't do these kind of calculations very often. The default, Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow says that the default mode of thinking is the fast intuitive system, which is based on images, thoughts, heavily associated with feelings, positive, negative feelings or emotions. You know, and this is. I liken this to a compass. The FAST system is our compass. It helps us go through our day. You know, we rely on it all the time. So, let's say I have an assignment due at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's noon. You know, I still have a lot of work to do on it. It's noontime, and I'm hungry. Should I, you know, work through lunch in order to increase the chances of meeting the deadline? Or should I satisfy my hunger and increase the probability that I might not get the assignment done in time? How do I make that decision? I don't sit down with a pencil and paper and think about what economists would say the utility of having lunch now and the utility of having my assignment done on time and what are the probabilities of success or failure, and then multiplying those utilities by their probabilities to get at some expected value that I compare the expected value of eating lunch and the expected value of meeting my obligation and not eating lunch, and see which is higher and then go for the higher. And that's kind of the original notion is the maximization of expected utility with some form of calculations that we do. Well, we do that fast and fluidly. You know, our brains do those calculations, you know, in seconds. You know, we just get a thought about, you know, eating, a thought about meeting our deadline, and the neurons in our brain blend those in ways that we don't fully understand. You know, people think maybe this has to do with the way neurons, the dopamine transmission in neurons, does these calculations for us, you know, quickly, and then we do it. But we don't sit down and wrestle with this in a very slow thing. We make it quickly. So and most of the time these things work. I mean, most of us, we get through the day. And think about driving, all the decisions you make in driving, where you've learned from experience, you're not calculating risks and benefits of different actions in the car. You've learned how to do this very fast and quickly. You have to. So this way of thinking is phenomenal, and we rely on it all the time. And sometimes, and most of the time, it works. And the same thing with other heuristics. They're useful, but sometimes they lead us astray, and we need to recognize when that might happen and defend against it. So it's like, I mean, I think it's a bit like visual illusions. So the human visual system is very, you know, rational, and our eyesight is not as good as that of some birds or other creatures, but it's good enough so that when we see something in front of us, usually that's what it is, and we can deal with it, successfully. But the study of visual illusions shows us that there are certain patterns, of light and design on in front of us that mislead the eye. So we think that A is bigger than B when B is bigger than A, things like that. Well, that shows that the visual system, as good as it is, breaks down in some circumstances. And I think it's the same thing with this fast intuitive system, which is good, but it breaks down in certain ways. And we need to understand that and deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And so in order to understand that, you've already talked about rationality and what you mean by rational. Could you now explain the concept of bounded rationality and perhaps give a couple of examples where it applies?
Well, I think that was a reaction to what early people in the judgment and decision-making field interpreted as assertions from economics, that people were rational, that if they had the proper information, they would make decisions that were kind of optimal, they were rational in the sense that this was good and optimal. And what Herbert Simon in the 1950s told us, and he had experiments to back this up, was that, well, we're not quite that good. Clearly, our attention is an important factor in guiding our behavior, and we know our attention is limited. Our memories are limited, and so we have to work with certain limitations that are kind of built into the human brain, and that we can't necessarily optimize and get the highest value out of every decision. And he created a concept called satisficing, that we do things that are good enough, even if they're not the absolute best. So this is kind of a brief element of the fact that we are rational, but not perfectly, maximally rational. And I certainly think that is a concept that has stood the test of time, and I think that we have shown that the work on, as we learn more about how judgments and decisions are made, we see that yes, we are not maximizing things in that way. We just hope that we're doing good enough, and sometimes we do things that are good enough, and sometimes We don't. We're not, you know, we need to improve. We need to be better. So, I mean, I think, I don't think many people would disagree with the notion that we're not perfectly rational. And so we were maybe using a kind of a overly idealistic model that we thought economists were putting forth, perfect rationality. Well, okay, it's not the case. Simon helped us, you know, break that barrier. And once you open that door a little bit, you see all the different ways that we are less than optimal, and sometimes seriously so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's talk about risk and risk perception, because I guess that this is very important to introduce this theme here, because it will pave the way for us to talk later about health issues and climate issues and things like that. So what would you say first that you would consider to be the most important things for people to know about how humans perceive risk, and perhaps that can lead to problems, let's say?
First, what we've learned is that risk is a very complex concept. I mean, it's a simple word. We use it all the time. We think we know what we mean when we use it in a sentence, and then the very next sentence we'll use it in a different way, and without even realizing that we're not consistent in the meaning of it. So basically, when you start to think carefully about how it's used, you see that there's at least four different meanings that we commonly use. There probably are more, but I look at four. The first, we use risk to mean a hazard. Something that can hurt us is a risk. You know, it's actually an activity or a technology is a risk if it's got harmful consequences. The second way we use it is when we really mean probability. How likely, you know, what is the risk of something happening? We're really implying, how likely is it? A third way is we use it when we mean the consequence. I mean, what's the risk of letting my parking meter expire? The risk of letting that expire is a consequence. It's getting a ticket, paying a fine. So it's a consequence. And I think that, you know, perhaps the most logical meaning of it is a blend of how likely something is to happen and how harmful are the consequences. And some people would say, well, you should take both of those into account by multiplying some value of the consequence by the probability. You have two numbers, you can multiply them. Well, sometimes you can do that. Sometimes you don't have the probability as a number. Sometimes you don't know the consequence as a number. I mean, sometimes if it's a loss of an amount of money, you've got a fixed numerical consequence. But most of the time, the probabilities and the consequences are fuzzy in our mind. They're diffuse. And so we have to kind of do that kind of multiplication in a fast, intuitive way. Anyway, you see that just from the start, the word itself is problematic and often used, you know, in diverse ways by the same person, you know, from one moment to the next. Second, we see that the likelihoods and the values of the consequences, as I mentioned, are not precisely defined. So how do we even know what they are? And so there's two ways to know. One is to use this system two, this analytic thinking, and to collect data and to calculate frequencies and probabilities and all kinds of, you know, numbers to indicate how common or how likely something is to happen. Another is to put a number on the consequence. If it doesn't have already a number, like an amount of money, you create some numerical measure and you do calculations and things like that. So it's kind of a statistical, mathematical approach. So that's one way to assess risk, and it's very important. And you have people who are very very good at it. You know, the physicists, engineers, biologists, who can actually put numbers on to indicate the riskiness. We have the Society for Risk Analysis, and a major component of that, the people who belong to that are people who are very skilled at quantifying risk with these, you know, formulae and equations, either based both on theory and data. Very, very important. I mean, that's how, you know, engineers design airplanes or other systems. You know, they use calculations and which affect their, how the likelihood of some component failing and causing a devastating accident and so forth. Okay, so we need to do that kind of analysis. But again, going back to the default in Kahneman sense, most of the time we regular people judge risk by our feelings. You know, we have a sense of likelihood and severity that conveys anxiety, worry, or just some sort of negative sense in us, or sometimes fear or sadness, or, you know, so we use our feelings as the guide to how risky something is. And if our feelings have been trained by experience, you know, some people are very experienced in, you know, in like the firefighters, for example, they've done this a lot, they know what behaviors might be more or less risky for them to do in confronting a fire, like we had at Notre Dame last week. You know, you learn by experience, or other times you just kind of learn. It's just the way things appear to you, and your feelings could not be very calibrated with what is going on. And so what I and some of my colleagues do is we try to understand this concept of risk as a feeling. And again, how does the brain create feelings? How do these feelings influence us? And what we're finding are all kinds of fascinating kind of weirdness about the feeling. The feeling system, again, it's most of the time it works, you know, and especially if it's based on experience that has trained our feelings. But other times when the situations are kind of novel or extreme, we haven't had a lot of experience, and we just kind of confront the situation, then the feelings are, I would say, biased. I'll use that word, and really, really mislead us. So, and the feeling system does perform calculations, you know, that influence how strongly we feel about something, how worried or anxious or unconcerned. And we have a term for that in what, called the arithmetic of compassion. When the feelings have to do with whether you should go to the aid or rescue someone at risk, that these feelings, this is the feeling system does things which are bizarre and I would argue non-rational, because they don't help us achieve the goal of that we would think we would want to achieve. So one example of the problem, the feeling system, feelings, our brain doesn't do arithmetic on feelings. One example comes from an experiment that Christopher Shee and Yuval Rotenstrike did at University of Chicago a few years ago, when they had two groups of people, and they told these people, in this experiment, we're going to expose you to some chance of getting a strong electric shock. I mean, it won't really harm you, but it won't be very, you know, it's a strong shock. How much would you pay to get out of this experiment? up to $20. You can pay up to $20. What's the most you would pay so you don't have to take part in this weird experiment? And then they had two groups of people. One group, they said, the probability of your getting the shock is 99%. The other group, they told, the probability of getting this shock is 1%. The 1% group paid almost as much as the 99% group to get out of the experiment. They had two other groups where instead of shock, the outcome was losing $20. There they found that the 99% group would pay a lot more to get out of the experiment than the 1%. So it wasn't that people couldn't sense probability in that way. They were very sensitive when it was loss of money. When it was getting the shock, they were insensitive to the likelihood. What I think is, how I interpret that experiment is that the way people decided how much to pay was a function of how anxious they felt about being in that experiment. And I think that anxiety comes from thinking about the shock, the consequence. So you think about the shock, and the consequence itself makes you anxious. But then you're told it's a 1% chance or a 99% chance. There's no way that the brain can multiply a feeling of anxiety by a probability. You know, that kind of arithmetic calculation doesn't happen. The only way you can do it, you could do a more calculus, is if you move that 1% to zero. And then, you know, then the feeling goes away. If you think this is impossible, it's not going to happen, then you relax. But as long as you entertain that thought of getting a shock, you know, it's not zero, you're anxious and you'll respond. So that's one example of the problem of the feelings. You don't do arithmetic very well. And then we found in my own research, well, I should go back and say that Kahneman and his colleague Amos Tversky, Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in 2002 in economics, even though he's a psychologist. And Amos Tversky, his longtime colleague, would have also shared the prize with him had he not died prematurely in 1996. So one of the things that they won the prize for was a theory called prospect theory. The centerpiece of prospect theory is something that they call the value function. It's how much we value things as the amount increases or decreases, and or whether it's a gain or a loss. And so it's kind of a function that's with the amount is on the x-axis, the value is on the y-axis, and the function is nonlinear. Let's say for gains, and illustrated say with money. That is, if you gain $100, you'll feel good. It has value for you. If you gain $200, you won't perceive that as twice as, it doesn't feel twice as valuable as 100. It's something less than twice. It starts to curve off, you know. And if you're a millionaire, an extra $100, you won't notice it. So that $100 does not have a constant meaning. It's influenced by how much you already have, or where, you know, the amounts that you already have. So and it kind of flattens up. So the function is very steep from around zero, and then it flattens out. We call it a psychophysical function because that's the same way our eyes respond to light energy, or our ears respond to sound energy. That, you know, we're very sensitive at small levels, and we become insensitive at large levels. So in a quiet room, you can hear a whisper. You see the difference. You hear something different. In a loud room, you won't hear that whisper. It takes a lot more change in energy for you to notice a difference in sound. It's the same thing with the way we respond to money. And what we've also found is, unfortunately, that's also the way we respond to gains and losses of human lives. That we're very sensitive about the first life that's in danger, or that has, you know, we've lost. 0 to 1 is huge, and the function, the value of that is large. And then the second, if there are two people at risk, it doesn't feel twice as bad as one. It's something less than twice. And by the time you get to 87 lives at risk, and then if I said, oh no, wait a minute, there's 88, you won't feel any different. thinking about 88 lives at risk than 87. That life, which is so important, if it's the first life, loses its value against the backdrop of a larger number of lives. And because the feeling system doesn't add. So if the feeling system adds, then as the number increased, you get a straight line, a linear. The value of protecting those lives would increase in a straight line. It doesn't do that. It goes up and it flattens out. And at some point, we become insensitive. So we hear that, 200,000 people have been murdered in Darfur a few years ago. And then we say, now the statistics, it may be 400,000. You won't feel any different. 200,000, there's 200,000 more lives. The feeling system can't handle that. It can't add, and it can't multiply. And so we say that the arithmetic of compassion, compassionate feelings, is a flawed, deadly arithmetic. It's not a rational arithmetic. And so that's built into the function of the value of prospect theory that has been such a successful theory. But we've taken that a lot further in looking at what the implications are for catastrophic losses, whether it's due to violence or to disease or climate change or whatever. That's that insensitivity. What we've also found, and we do experiments. We do experiments in the laboratory. We give people the opportunity, say, to donate to children who are facing starvation, and we increase the number of children, and we see what the donation response is. That's how we kind of get some control studies. But then we get a result. We then look and see, does this make sense with what we see going on in the world? So for example, in order to test this nonlinear theory, at the time we were looking for a way to do an experiment on it. And this was in the middle of the 1990s, just after the Rwandan genocide, which took place in 1994. And we saw an article in the newspaper that said that those who survived the genocide fled to refugee camps on the border between Rwanda and what was then Zaire. It's now part of Congo. And they began to suffer from cholera because they didn't have clean water, so there were epidemics of cholera in the camp. And so the news article was about the need for people in neighboring countries to supply well drilling and pumping equipment that could create new fresh water supplies in the camp. So we used that as the basis of a scenario in an experiment where we told people that imagine you're an official in a neighboring country, you want to help the people in the camp, and you have enough money to provide drilling and pumping equipment to provide fresh water to 4,500 people in the camp, but you've got other uses for your money. You could spend that money domestically. You could improve your hospitals, your schools, your roads. Would you spend the money and send it to help bring clean water and protect 4,500 people? And so people made that decision. And then the experiment was, we varied two things. We had two groups of people. In one group, we told them that you'll protect 4,500 people. Oh, the camp has 250,000 people in the camp. Second group, you'll protect 4,500 people. The camp has 11,000. Would you send it? So people were much more likely to send the money to the camp in the small camp than in the large, because it felt seemed more effective. It's on the steep part of the curve. That is, you're saving half the people in the camp, whereas going from 250,000 at risk to 245,000 or so didn't seem like it made any difference. But it's the same 4,500 lives. And so it illustrates this nonlinear reaction to number, which is not rational, because what's rational is, it's not the percentage of lives you save, it's the number of lives you save. So that's just one example of how you can do experiments on this, to test this nonlinear sense of value for protecting human life.
Okay, so that's very interesting, and there's lots of things there to unpack. So let's start with this, because I guess that all of the things you just told us about, they have huge implications in several different areas of human activity, like, for example, health and medicine and the environment, and we could pick on two very distinct examples, like, for example, GMOs and vaccines, because I guess that, they are a bit complex in the sense that there are different factors influencing people here, like, for example, the fact that when they think about GMOs and vaccines, they immediately associate them with artificial things, and then it's very intuitive for people to think that natural things are good and artificial things are bad. And then when people make some poorly designed studies that go viral, like, for example, Andrew Wakefield in the 90s tried to establish a connection or a link between vaccination and autism, and we now know that those studies were really poorly designed, but anyway, they really went viral among people and spread among them, and it's really, since they appeal to people's intuitions, it's really hard to go back and to explain them how the science behind vaccination, for example, works, and to really try to go around their intuitions and convince them that really things like vaccination don't have problems. And then when we go to talk about GMOs, for example, I mean, it's not only a health issue, it's also an environmental one, and people think that, for example, organic agriculture is better just because it simply doesn't use pesticides, supposedly, because in fact it also uses pesticides. But I mean, when people look at those studies again that were poorly designed, that supposedly established the link between ingesting GMO food and the growth of some tumors or cancers and things like that. But this is where we really also go back to what I was talking about earlier, about the conflict between lay people and experts, because these are things that really appeal to people's intuitions and people have strong emotional reactions to them. And it's very hard, because science is counterintuitive, to really try to calm people down and to expose them to the correct information, to try to really make them adopt that kind of approach to things, a scientific, deliberative approach based on critical thinking, let's say. And the problem here is that these can have very negative influences at a collective or social level. I mean, it's not that someone as an individual has these ideas and it is only him or her that has to deal with the negative consequences, but these really might have, and particularly in the long run, a very negative impact on society, right?
So what you're talking about is the complexity of trying to navigate between a world of science and a world where you're so much influenced by your feelings. And again, the feelings are responded to thoughts that go through the mind very, very quickly. Thoughts, images, you know, photographs, names. This is what we call the affect heuristic. These things that our senses bring to our attention are we call them tag. There's like affective tags that they're linked to. They cause feelings in us, and And so those feelings are there. And then we've got the scientific information and which way do we go? And a lot of that has to do with trust. You know, the easiest thing is to trust the scientists, to trust the regulators of the technologies or the products. If we have trust with and they tell us it's safe, we don't have to worry. We can go about and do things that are more fun. We don't have them sitting around worrying about whether we should eat this food that looks good and that we like, or whether it will, you know, harm us in, you know, 20 years or something. We don't want to have to do that. We just want to enjoy and do our, you know, live our lives rather than think about all these risk issues. But if we have some evidence that maybe we can't trust them, you know, that they're really the companies that bring us all these wonderful technologies and products are really more interested in their profits than in bringing us safe products, then we have to get our defenses up and we start to, you know, it's very, very problematic. So the issue of trust is important as well. So there's no right answer. You can't necessarily say that we always should look at science and put our feelings aside, make sure we don't let our feelings, you know, our emotions make us irrational. There's a sense that people used to say that emotions make us irrational. You know, where does that come from? Well, it's the sense that we know that sometimes that people who are very angry do things that they later regret. You know, that the emotion of extreme anger compromises our rational sense and we do stupid things. So emotions are bad. Well, no, emotions, you know, we have emotions because most of the time they were essential to survival, you know. And so just like, you know, the heuristics, I mean, they work, they have a purpose. And the same thing with our feelings. So I distinguish between an emotion, which is this strong, visceral sense that, you know, affects you physically. Your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, you know, versus what I call affect. Affect is, I call a faint whisper of emotion. It's the sense that something is not right. You know, if something is, you know, something's good or bad, you're not in an emotional state when you think about whether something is good or bad, or even whether something deserves anger. You don't have, you can think about something that is deserves anger, but you're not in a state of anger. You're just sort of sensing the negativity, the you know, through your feelings. And we call this the affect heuristic, the reliance on feelings as your compass. And so with regard to something like vaccinations, you know, if you read a story about a parent who vaccinated their child, and the child right after that got autism or something, you know, and you see that connection, that's a strong, a connection that creates a negative association with vaccinations, which is very hard to overcome there, unless you trust the manufacturers of the vaccines, the medical community. If you trust them, then it won't have that impact. So a lot of times trust has to do with whether one can experience the positives and negatives. A lot of the good things that happen are invisible. You know, you only see things when they fail. For example, a lot of people oppose nuclear power, and we started to look at that in the 1990s. I mean, people in the United States, we haven't allowed new nuclear power plants since, I don't know, right, 1970s. We're a very anti-nuclear power society. We have 100 reactors, but it's been hard. All those are old reactors, and we basically are anti-nuclear. Anyway, we ask people, what's the first thing that you think of when you hear the word nuclear power? And we found, this was in the 1990s, a significant percentage of people, the first thought had to do with bombs, you know, with atomic bomb, or they would say a mushroom cloud. You know, so the word nuclear triggers an image that's linked to the origin of of this technology, which is unfortunately in the bomb, and it creates negative feelings. And we found that if a person had that association, they were more likely to be opposed to nuclear power technology, even though this is nuclear power, not nuclear bombs. So that's kind of the way the mind works. It's got these associations in it. And even scientists are influenced by their feelings. The toxicologists who study the risks and benefits very scientifically of chemicals, they also have a sense that some chemicals are good or bad chemicals, and that influenced their interpretation of evidence. And when you look to see how the experts come up with their conclusions, sometimes they struggle as well. So for example, our chemicals, the exposure to very small amounts of chemicals in food, air, water, you know, is it safe? Very difficult question to answer. So what the toxicologist does is to expose, you know, laboratory animals, rats and mice, to high levels of this chemical for the lifetime of the animal. And then they look to see if that there were tumors or cancerous tumors that occurred as a result of this exposure compared to some control group that didn't get this exposure. And then they say, okay, now if they see this is a warning sign. And then they try to project what that means for a human, different species, exposed to a very tiny amount of this chemical for a short period of time. And so they create a mathematical model that tries to lead them to predict from the high exposures to the low. Well, okay, is that accurate or not? You know, a lot of people would say that you can't do that prediction. It's too different. So there's conflict even within the science in terms of the validity of the methods. So the scientists are trying to help us understand a very difficult question, which is the exposure to small amounts or to GMO foods, you know, which again creates small changes in a plant product. You know, how does science determine what the long-term impact will be? It's not obvious, so naturally people they would like to trust the scientists, but if they hear a report about a company that's producing these GMO products that is doing something illegal in order to maximize their profits, then suddenly they get defensive, which it makes sense. Again, that's a feeling response, which is not irrational, you know. And we see a good very striking example of that a few weeks ago with the airplanes, you know, the Boeing 737 MAX systems, which we had the accident a few months ago in Indonesia, a new plane, brand new plane, which plunged in the sea. And then we have another accident just a few weeks ago, I think it was in Thailand. The same plane, the same kind of failure, and it looks as though there is the automated system, which attempts to protect the plane from ascending too steeply and stalling. There's a sensor on the that looks at the angle the plane's going with, and if it's too steep, it forces the nose down so it doesn't stall. Well, the sensors. There was a flaw in this system. The sensors were sending the wrong data. It's like the feeling system sending the wrong data to your brain, you know, and leading to a correction that in this case was catastrophic. So then the question is, then you start to look at how did the manufacturer respond after the first one of these? Did they quickly fix it? And it looked like they did not act optimally. You know, on the basis of this first thing, they were too slow, and they didn't train pilots or even inform pilots adequately about it. So now you see that the management of this, or the response to this by the manufacturer and by the regulator, was not what it could be. And that sort of shakes your trust a bit. And people right now, I think, you know, not only would it might be uneasy about flying in these planes, but this reflects on Boeing, this fantastic company which makes these incredible machines. They too are in jeopardy of becoming stigmatized by the thought that they didn't do the right thing here. And that's a feeling response, you know, and they can show a lot of statistics out. Most of the time their planes work, fortunately. But again, even these couple of examples shake people's confidence in the system, and people respond. Well, that's not irrational. I mean, it depends. You know, if they do correct it and it's proven that it's corrected, and people still don't do it, well, that's you can question that. But you see how complex risk is from the scientific standpoint, and from the way our minds react to these things. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one of the things you referred there when you talked about plane crashes and things like that, you were referring to one of the phenomena that we refer to as the availability heuristic, right? That, I mean, when people are exposed to certain things with a certain frequency, like, for example, if they are exposed to a plane crash, 100 or more people die at the same time, but perhaps in a car crash, only one or two or three or four die. And so when they are exposed to those sorts of events, it's easier for them to stick in their memory, and perhaps they overreact to low probability events and discount the really high risk events. And perhaps the same thing happens with things like terrorist acts, where really, in terms of percentage, very few people die as victims of them, but people really overreact to them because they have blood and they have corpses and they have bombings and things like that, and many times in the media they depict them in a very theatrical way or something like that. So, I mean, that's also another thing that really affects how people judge risk, the ways they are exposed to certain information, and also the frequency that it appears, for example, in the media. And perhaps we could also include social media, that perhaps nowadays contributes to exacerbate that effect, right?
Absolutely, the availability. I mean, notion is the ease with which we can remember past events, or we can think of the images of this thing happening. It goes back again to the electric shock experiment, where the experiment made available in people's mind the possibility that they would suffer a shock. So they were, again, thinking they had an image of getting shocked. And then that conveys feelings, which becomes the representation of risk for them. It's that feeling. And we see that feeling isn't regulated very much by how likely something is, unless you have overwhelming, experience, which shows you that it really doesn't happen, and then things can, your feelings will gradually adapt to the fact that it's not happening. But so in all these different ways, the images, the availability was the first sense we had that memory and imagination was linked to our sense of frequency and risk. Now we see that another aspect of that is when you imagine something happened or you remember it happening, it is conveying more or less feeling, affect, or other kinds of, or fear. So not only are you thinking about something, which is made easier if it's in the newspapers a lot, but also it is, in some cases, conveying a strong negative feeling, which then is a representation of risk. So the feelings amplify the effects of the availability heuristics. It works together. We didn't see that at first, although we did notice that sensational causes of death. We did a study in 1978 based on availability, it showed that the more kind of sensational media coverage there was led to kind of an overestimation of the likelihood that this kind of event would happen. So that was the first hint we had, but that was early in our, before we really appreciated the role of feelings here. It took us a while. The way we really started to appreciate the role of feelings was when we asked people to judge the risk and the benefit of different activities like flying in a plane or taking a prescription medicine, how beneficial are medicines, how risky, and so forth, or pesticides, how beneficial are they, how risky. And we found that people's judgments of risk and benefit went in opposite direction. If something was high in risk, it was judged low in benefit. If it was judged low in risk, it was judged high in benefit. That there was this inverse relationship. When in the world, risk and benefit tend to go together positively. You know that things that have high risk but low benefit, we get rid of those. We don't want anything that exposes us to risk without a commensurate benefit. So across different activities in the world, risk and benefit go together positively. In people's minds, they went together negatively. And we later learned, it took us a while, we didn't think much about it, and then we started to think, well, let's try to understand that. When we studied it further, we found that the reason they went together negatively was that people first relied on how they felt about the activity. You know, did they like it or did they dislike it? And then they judge risk and benefit consistent with how they felt with it. So if I don't like pesticides, they're the bad form of chemicals, I would judge them as high in risk and low in benefit. If I see medicines as beneficial, then I judge them as high in benefit and low in risk. Even though medicines can have harms and pesticides can have benefits, we have our brain puts a more simplistic frame that things that are good have to be high in benefit and low in risk, even when they're not in the world. So then we started to appreciate, that's what led us to think about what we call the affect heuristic, yet another one of these many heuristics, which Kahneman and Tversky said was one that they missed. They had availability bias, representative heuristic, but they didn't think about the affect heuristic. And I think I'm biased, but I think the affect heuristic is one of the most important things to understand about how our minds process information when we're particularly when we're thinking fast.
So I guess that one of the most pressing issues that we have in at hand right now is climate change. So and people are saying that we have sort of a 11-year window to try to really tackle it seriously, otherwise we will get to a point where we will start getting irreversible climatic effects or environmental effects. So climate change also has the additional problem that it really seems like something that will happen very far in the future. So it is very easy for people to discount it as a problem and a risk, right?
Fortunately. Yes, right. Our brains didn't evolve to help us make decisions about something like climate change, which is very slow, gradual. It's not directly visible because and it has many components to it. It's you know, not any one single thing that we can observe suddenly changing. I mean, the climate has always been changing. I mean, weather changes. Weather changes. Climate is, you know, how does weather relate to climate? Weather is what we see right around us and what we experience. We experience weather. It's experiencing climate is more subtle. It's the weather over some large amount of time and in different types of outcomes. You know, it's much more complicated. than whether it's a hot or cold day or whether it's snowing or not or whatever. That's hard for us to appreciate the small changes, because we don't experience it directly, and it's against a background of constantly variable weather, and it's not just in one direction. Climate change is not, we talk about global warming, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it only warming. We see it's extremes. The climate change means extremes, hot and cold, precipitation and drought, violent storms, things like that. It's all these things which don't directly trigger this experiential concern, the sense that we are vulnerable. What we also see in this research, risk research, is that you have to have a feeling of personal vulnerability that to maximize your likelihood that you'll do something. And many of us don't feel vulnerable to these changes, because, as you said, we think that they're still far away in time, and far away in places. This is going to happen somewhere else a long time from now, and I've got more important things to worry about, is one thing. So it doesn't trigger that negative feelings that when you look analytically at what the world is going to, what are all the consequences that are going to happen. I mean, they're more kind of like theoretical. They appear theoretical to us, and so then when you get the information, you get the scientific data. So you see that suddenly the scientists predict a certain increase in sea level rise, 10 or 20 years from now, and they give it to us in millimeters or centimeters. What does that mean? How do we understand the consequences that will, carry that will occur there? It doesn't convey feeling, and when information doesn't convey feeling, we don't really understand it, and it doesn't motivate us to act. So one way then is to make this experiential is to say, well, if you are one of the many millions of people who live along a coastline, here's what this sea level rise will look like on your part of the coast, and you then make projections of the water coming in and flooding out places that you currently live, or places where you go to recreate, or where cities are located, and they're now being flooded out, and so forth. So you create consequences that have images that carry feeling. That will be a more powerful way to communicate than just by the numbers. And we know that, again, because the feeling system doesn't do numbers, it reacts to images. So give people images, and we can do that. We have ways to design visual scenes that are faithful to the science and so forth. The same thing when we noticed about the numbers, we looked at the death toll in Syria and the Syrian war, which started in 2011, where there was uprising against the government of Syria, and the government cracked down viciously. They say, "Well, we're going to stop this," and they started to murder protesters or hang them. Do really violent. To people who were protesting the government. And then that escalated, and suddenly there was kind of an all-out attacks by the government on people who were opposing the government. It just started in 2011. By 2015, there had been like 250,000 deaths in this conflict, a high percentage of them civilians. So that was the numbers, and I'm not going from sea level rise in numbers to the number to 250,000. Yes, no one cared. And how do we know? You could see that there wasn't anything going on politically to try to intervene and protect these people. But also, if you look at the number of people searching on Google under the search term "Syria and refugees," it was low and flat. And then suddenly, one day in September 2015, all that changed. And you see a tremendous interest in Syria and refugees. What did it? It was the picture, the photograph of a little boy on the beach, you know, fleeing with his family, trying to get to Turkey, and the boat capsized, and the little boy was lying there face down in the sand, Aylan Kurdi. That picture went around the world. It grabbed people emotionally, and suddenly people woke up and cared about what was going on in Syria and with this with refugees in ways that the statistics of 250,000 deaths didn't move them. So it's the same thing. The data on climate change as data isn't moving us. We need to see it in terms of consequences and in order to appreciate it. So I'm very pessimistic that we're going to do anything. It's already late in the game on that, and I think we're going to continue to underreact. We're underreacting to this threat because it doesn't stir our feelings and emotions like it should. And the science is there, and the data are there, but we're not reacting to that viscerally. And it's starting to happen. And of course, the more things do start affecting us, then we will react. But we should be acting way in advance of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me just ask you two more general theoretical questions about all of what we've been talking about during the interview. And the first one, picking on what you've just said about how when people were exposed to the number of deaths in the Syrian conflict, they didn't really care that much, and then suddenly when they were exposed to the dead body of that little child, Aylan Kurdi, on the beach, then suddenly they really started caring a lot, or a lot more at least, about it. Because, I mean, to what extent do you think that teaching people about these things, about biases and heuristics and the cognitive mental shortcuts that people have and that operate automatically in their minds, might be useful to try to counter the negative effects that these things have on people's behavior and decision-making processes? Because I guess that from what you said, it seems to me that it would be easier and it would have a much bigger effect on people if we simply perhaps change the environment and the ways we expose people to information, in a sense manipulating them a little bit and tweak their systems in order to make them have sort of appropriate reactions to things, because I'm also a bit skeptical that simply teaching them about these sorts of things and how their mind operates, that really would have an important positive effect on them. Also because we have mechanisms like the bias blind spot, where people that even know about these biases and heuristics, they arrive at a point where they think that they are no longer subject to them, and then they might also be even more under the influence of them because they don't notice their effects or something like that.
I think that the first step has to be to create awareness of how we think about the world in this regard, that there's no guarantee that by educating people, starting at a young age, about the ways that our minds both benefit us and mislead us, there's no guarantee that suddenly the whole world will be transformed. But I think you have to. It starts with awareness, and then the question is: okay, in some cases, awareness might change people. I mean, this is just like, you know, teaching people to be moral, to be kind, to be compassionate. You know, this is what happens every day in, you know, every week in religious institutions, where people are taught basic principles of how to be good to each other and make the world better. Well, that's in a way kind of to de-bias evil and greed and other things. Well, obviously, it's not. We still have these evils, but is it useful for billions of people to kind of worship in some way that tries to provide principles to live by? And I think it's the same thing with the way our minds work. I mean, what could be more important to understand is how our minds work, and in ways that we may not be that may not be obvious to us. A lot of this stuff is very subtle, and we wouldn't think of it if research hasn't identified this. And then suddenly, now we know about it. Well, let's use it. I mean, one example that comes out of this arithmetic of compassion. By the way, we have a website devoted to educating people about arithmetic of compassion. Is the fact that if you have a chance to help someone, and you might do it or you might not, depending on your ability to help them. But you know, you have this opportunity to help, and then suddenly there's some negative information comes in, either about people you can't help or about something else bad going on. That negative information comes in and makes you feel less good about helping the child or the person, and you don't help. So we help others not only because they need our help, but because we feel good and we expect to feel good when we help. And what we find is that irrelevant information that has a negative affect comes in and is not blocked out by the brain. The brain lets all sorts of sensory information in to blend in with the relevant information. And it messes up that relevant information. You don't feel as good about helping this child when you become aware that there's other children you're not helping. And so then you don't help the child, even though you can help that child. I say that's not rational. I mean, you should not be demotivated from doing good that you can do just because there's other things that you can't do. So I think people need to know about that and be educated about that, so they can be on guard, not to, you know, to think about doing what they can do and not to be demotivated by things they can't do. Now, that's a principle. Can we teach that to children? I think you can start teaching that to young children at an early age, so that they're sensitive to the fact that you focus on what you can do and you block out. You have to work to block out the fact that, that what you can't do, that's not relevant. Things like that. We don't know. We have to try and see if we can educate people to overcome certain of these reactions, which I think are not, I would say, are truly non-rational.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just one last question, and this is an interest of mine because I've been having a lot of evolutionary psychologists on the show. So when we talk about these biases, like the confirmation bias, the heuristics, like the availability heuristic, the effect heuristic, and things like that, I'm not sure about if there's lots of cross-cultural variation in terms of the extent to which people are affected by these biases and heuristics, and even if there are certain people that don't experience them at all. I'm not sure about that. But do you think that it is possible to talk about them with the evidence that we have as human universals? That is, do people in general have these biases and heuristics? And if so, do you think that it makes sense to deal with them as being mental mechanisms or cognitive mechanisms that are the result of natural selection, because probably during our evolutionary history they were useful to us?
I hesitate to say that any of this is completely universal across the vast diversity of human culture and experience. I don't, and it's I don't think we have adequate research in different cultures to demonstrate that something is truly universal. And we know that culture is a very powerful influencer. And so, for example, some cultures are more collective in their orientation, and they look at the welfare of the group. And others are more, I think our culture here in the West is very individualistic. We put the individual well-being often ahead of the well-being of a larger group. That's a cultural difference that could affect the way we react to this function about the psychic numbing. You know, maybe the collective people are less susceptible to numbing when there's a lot of people at harm than we are. I think this is a research question, and it's hard to do this research cross-nationally, cross-culturally, because you have to have people in different, you know, working with you. You have problems of translating materials of it, you know, and it's just not as easy to do that research. So I think a lot of this work has not been done. So I would say that there's likely cultural influence that we need to be aware of that possibility. I don't know how universal some of these phenomena are. Maybe they only affect 2 billion people on the planet instead of 6 billion.
Yeah, perhaps the weird people, as you call them now in social psychology, right?
Right. So we do know, you know, how they. We do think that they're fairly universal in within certain cultures where there's a lot, large number of people that are affected by it. Whether it's even if it's not everybody, it's still, you know. So again, I think that's an open question that needs further study.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very well. So, Dr. Slovic, just before we go, you made reference to your website, The Arithmetic of Compassion. What other online sources could people go to learn more about your work?
Well, that source does show a lot of recent work on compassion. But our organization, Decision Research, has its own website, just Decision Research. .org, and if you go there and you look there, it shows, gives publications, it gives for not only me but others in our organization. I think it's easy to get access to my work on the internet, and I'm happy to provide materials to send people whatever papers. We don't do proprietary, you know, private work. We make everything we do is. Available, we make available to whoever's interested.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will be leaving links to all of that in the description box of the video so that people can go and check those sources out. So, Dr. Slovic, again, I would really like to thank you for taking the time to be here with us on the show. It was really a pleasure to everyone, and maybe in the future we could do another conversation, I don't know.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to talk with you, and I would be happy to consider future discussions. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to my channel and for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel on February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would really like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Any amount, even $1, would already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. You also have the alternative of supporting me on Subscribestar or PayPal. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons, Karen Litske, Anne Blanchett, Peruga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelina, Jim Frank, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Brian Rivera, Lucas Stafiniak, Sergio Condriano, Jan Haninen, and my two producers. These are Weber and Rosie. Thank you for all.